From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with GPB and NPR today for continuing coverage of the recovery efforts in West Georgia counties and Lee County in southeastern Alabama, devastated by a tornado on Sunday. But we begin today with a schism in the United Methodist Church. Last week, the governing body of the church voted to uphold a ban on same-sex marriage and openly gay clergy. The so-called traditional plan won by a narrow margin at the annual meeting of the General Conference, defeating the one church plan, which would have allowed local congregations to make their own decisions on LGBT issues. Jan Love was at the conference. She is dean of the Candler School of Theology at Emory University, one of 13 Methodist seminaries in the country, and she's joining me now from a studio at Emory. Jan, welcome.
Good morning.
Well, for years, the Methodist Church has been taking these votes with the same results. LGBT advocates have tried to move the denomination more progressively. Each year, more conservative voices win out. So you were at the conference. What was the response to the vote?
I think the conference, the special called session of the General Conference, which happens normally every 4 years, was hard on everybody there. No one likes to participate in a legislative session where the conflicts run so deep. But the pain was excruciating for LGBTQ people, dedicated Christians, their families and friends. It was very hard on them, especially.
But the General Council is a global gathering of the church. Who gets to vote?
Each annual conference, which is the basic unit of organization in the church, gets to send delegates. And so about 40%, a little more than 40% of the delegates were from across parts of some parts of Africa, some parts of Europe and the Philippines. And then a little more than 50% of the delegates were from the United States.
So this, what impact did these international church representatives have on the vote, do you think?
Well, it's very clear that somewhere between 65 and 70% of the United States United Methodist delegates would have passed a plan that allowed for space whereby those who want to ordain LGBTQ pastors and marry gay couples would have been able to live together with those who conscientiously object to such. Mm. So we would give each other space to live together despite that pretty profound difference. The traditional plan was passed, however, by a margin of 54 votes. And it not only prohibits the ordination of gay people and prohibits the marriage of gay people, it also tightens the penalties for anyone who violates church law. It's a purity test of sorts.
Well, we have a note on Facebook. We do have a poll on Facebook asking the question, what do you think about the United Methodist Church's vote to continue its ban on same-sex marriage and LGBTQ clergy? So people can weigh in on that on our Facebook group, but we did get a response. Jad on Facebook, pretty much reflecting what you said, reports that a majority of U.S. delegates favored one church plan. But let's see. While allowing more conservative churches and ministers to opt for more traditionalist stance. And we do have a note here that he says that the African bloc pretty much voted en masse to go with the other plan. What do you think here? This is something that we saw in the Episcopal Church, certainly when Eugene Robinson was ordained, that the Global South, for the most part, did not agree with that. And there was a split in the church. Is that what it's looking like here?
It's accurate to say that the overwhelming majority of Africans, but also the Russians, people from Eastern Europe, were very clear in their speeches on the floor that they opposed the One Church plan. And it's only possible to retain the traditional plan with that overwhelming majority of votes from outside the United States, most of which are from Africa. So there are deep, deep cultural differences between churches in the Congo, in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, and churches in the United States, or Germany for that matter, or Scandinavia for that matter. So we have this giant cultural divide And the reality of the way the votes happen in the international dimensions of our church is that there are sufficient votes from outside the United States to determine what U.S. clergy and churchgoers can do, despite their opinions about what they should be allowed to do. That's not to say, however, that the United States is not also divided on the issue. It's just clear where the majority is.
Right. The responses have been rippling throughout congregations. We did reach out to Methodists in Georgia. We did not hear from anybody, behind the traditionalist plan. But here's a sample of responses from Asbury Memorial UMC. This is in Savannah.
I was very, very disheartened by what happened. I hoped until the very end that something would change, and it came awfully close, but in the end, it didn't change.
It kind of hurts that they're going this way and stuff. I hope that we can work it out where we can stay in the denomination, but if for some reason we don't, I know this congregation will be still a congregation and will still survive some way, somehow.
God is never static. God is always changing. If we follow God, He'll take us to greater love, deeper love, and that's where I'm interested in going.
The General Conference doesn't speak for all of us United Methodists. Nothing will separate us from our faith. We will continue to practice radical inclusion and radical hospitality to the most vulnerable, to the people that are oppressed. We will lift them up.
Ann Hagen there, Ray Ellis, who's also Minister of Music at Asbury, Susan Bollinger, and Lance Wilhelm of Asbury Memorial UMC in Savannah. So clearly, they oppose the traditional plan. The One Church plan would have allowed individual congregations and conferences to make up their own rules. So what was the opposition to local control?
The opposition is argued by traditionalists to be biblically based and to be based in the tradition of the Christian heritage. If you look, for example, at the Roman Catholic Church or the Greek Orthodox Church or the Russian Orthodox Church, which themselves call their own understandings of the faith the epitome of traditionalism, the Roman Catholics don't even ordain women. The Greek Orthodox don't ordain women. Protestants have more typically been ready to adapt to cultural contexts in places where the Enlightenment is a powerful force across decades and, history. So it's unusual for this kind of depth of difference to be based on tradition, but there are differences of understanding about how the Bible views this issue.
We are talking about United Methodist Church, now divided over inclusion of LGBTQ marriage and clergy after recent vote by the church's governing body. Jan Love is with us. She's dean of Emory University's Candler School of Theology, and we do have a poll on our Facebook group. You can weigh in on what you think about the church's vote. There was a full-page ad in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on Sunday signed by 300 members of clergy from around Georgia who opposed the vote, reading, among other things, "We say to our LGBT siblings, you are beloved children of God and are beloved by us." There were also plenty of people quoted who agree with the vote. Polls show American Methodists split on same-sex marriage. Is there a divide, do you think, between clergy and congregants?
I think the divide is more generational than it is between clergy and lay, although laity tend to be, on the whole, a bit more conservative than clergy are on the whole. But there are plenty of conservative clergy, and there are plenty of very progressive lay people. But across generations, the differences are profound, where those under 45, Pew Research demonstrates that those people who are under 45 years of age overwhelmingly accept LGBTQ people in all arenas of life, including in churches and faith communities. Mm-hmm. Those under 30, even more so. So the generational differences are huge, and the churches across the United Methodist Church in Georgia and everywhere else are populated primarily by people in their 50s. Mm. And so there is, for the future of the church, there is a lot to be studied on how we are ensuring that the gospel of Jesus Christ is reaching younger people when they consider, according to Pew Research, most churches to be too judgmental on this particular issue.
Beth LaRocca-Pitts is senior pastor at St. Mark's UMC, United Methodist Church in Atlanta, and she told us this could be the breaking point.
If someone was predisposed to leave the United Methodist Church because of this stance, many have left already because they could no longer in good conscience be a part of a discriminatory denomination.
So the word split coming up from a lot of people, even before the meeting, maybe anticipating the results. But it is not over yet. The Methodist Church has branches of government, much like the U.S. government. And apparently the Judicial Council might rule this vote unconstitutional. On what grounds do you think that might happen?
The traditional plan, eight parts of it have already been ruled unconstitutional prior to the vote. Nonetheless, they were adopted, and so the Judicial Council, or maybe it's the opposite, that eight parts were ruled constitutional and the remainder were ruled unconstitutional. But the delegates voted those parts into law anyway. So in April, the Judicial Council will actually rule again, and they're likely to be consistent with their previous rulings. And so the General Conference will meet again in 2020 and have another go at all of this. It's important to realize that the questions are still importantly unsettled because much of the traditional plan was not constitutional. The parts that increase the penalties, however, for breaking church laws were ruled constitutional by the Judicial Council. And so that will be enshrined in law and become effective January 1, 2020.
And what are those penalties?
Those penalties are that if you perform a same-sex marriage or union ceremony as a clergy member, the first time you do it, you will be suspended. The second time you do it, you will lose your clergy credentials.
So you're at Candler teaching future leaders of the Methodist Church. What are you hearing from your students about this vote?
Well, our students are, our median age is 27. So I live in the world of the under 30s, and they are devastated. They have very different convictions, and this is a matter of conscience for anybody. And so there's a variety of convictions about full inclusion of LGBTQ people in the clergy and marriages and all of that, but they are overwhelmingly distressed that this is the organizing principle for any church, that a church would choose to rotate its life, its governance, and its organizational life around this issue.
Jan Love is Dean of Emory University's Candler School of Theology. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is one of 13 Methodist seminaries in the country, and we're going to end with one of the most famous hymns Charles Wesley wrote, Caleb Brashy's Oh, for a Thousand Tongues to Sing. And we do want to hear from you. We do have a Facebook poll going on the United Methodist Church decision to go with a traditional plan, so weigh in there. And coming up, a look at how attitudes about LGBTQ issues changing in rural America. Transgender author reports on her red state road trip. Stay with us for more on Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A decade ago, Samantha Allen was a Mormon missionary knocking on doors in a suit and tie. Now she's married to a woman and a GLAAD award-winning reporter who set out to tell the stories of LGBT people in red states. Her book, Real Queer America, follows her own story and those of people who've worked to turn their communities into places of acceptance and of growth. And she's joining me now from Seattle. Samantha, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, a pleasure to have you. And what a book. It's kind of like a love letter to the open road and the way that the process of traveling helped you find yourself. What has that freedom meant for you?
For me, roads are places of possibility. Cars, you know, historically, as a transgender woman, cars were places where I felt like I could be myself. You know, they were the first places I could kind of, you know, wear the clothing I felt comfortable in, apart from prying eyes and just kind of drive. So cars have always been, to me, places of freedom and escape.
Well, this book was the product or the chronicle of a six-week cross-country road trip through LGBT communities in red states, not necessarily people who normally call attention to themselves. So how did you find the folks to talk to?
You know, a lot of my interviewees I had kind of met through personal connections. I'm lucky enough to have lived a lot of my life and made a lot of friends in red states like Georgia, Tennessee, Indiana, Texas. So a lot of the process of writing the book was reaching out to those friends saying, hey, I'd like to come visit you. I'd like to meet other people in your LGBT communities in your local areas and find out what you're up to, what kind of activism you have going on, what struggles you're dealing with, what you're celebrating.
And in addition to finding people that you knew, how did you decide how to plot this out? Was it personal relevance, political relevance, or maybe some kind of combination?
There was a little bit of both. So a lot of the states that I chose to visit were places that I had a real deep personal connection to. Utah is where I went to college before I came out as transgender and transitioned. Georgia is where I went to graduate school and transitioned. I made lifelong friends in Tennessee. I met my wife in Indiana. So a lot of the states were kind of personal choices. And then there were other places like Texas where I wanted to be because there were major political developments in LGBT national news happening. And that the year I wrote the book, 2017, Texas was considering a bathroom bill that would have restricted restroom usage by your original birth certificate gender marker. And so I wanted to be there in Texas that summer to see the protests against that bill.
So how was that to face the logistics of traveling as a trans person through these kind of places that were considering that legislation, for example? Did that make things hard in communities that weren't accepting?
You know, it's always made me a little nervous, especially after coming out to go on road trips. You know, when I first came out and I was more kind of visibly transgender than I am after, you know, 7 years on hormones, I was so scared and I would plot out, you know, oh, I'm going to use the restroom at this coffee shop at this point. I would literally like chart it out in advance. And
it sounds a little like the Green Book idea that people, African-American travelers, had to travel with the Green Book to know what was safe.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of, I don't know, you have to have your guard up a little bit. But at the same token, you know, I want to say that I found so much kind of welcome and hospitality in red states as an openly queer person. And you can kind of get in your own head about some of those safety concerns because I've felt welcome almost everywhere I've traveled. You know, I had a lot of friends warn me, a lot of friends from, you know, like New York or Los Angeles or something say, be careful before I went on this trip. And I didn't feel the need to be, I don't know, any more careful than I am anywhere else, per se.
Tell us some of those stories that might have surprised or touched you that where people showed you kindness and hospitality.
Oh, gosh. So many. But the one that most immediately jumps to mind was going back to Utah, to a town called Provo. It's about an hour south of Salt Lake City. I went to school there in 2005. I was still in the closet at the time. It just wasn't imaginable to me that I could be open and out in the LGBT community in Provo at the time. It didn't seem to exist. And then when I went back, there was this amazing LGBT youth center called Encircle that was literally across the street from the Mormon temple in Provo. And I spent most of my days there hanging out with LGBT youth and their parents, many of whom were still devout Mormons, but wanted to figure out ways to support their kids. And I met parents there who just showed me incredible warmth and acceptance. And I had one kind of Mormon guy in his 40s. He pulled me aside. He found out I was going on this road trip, and with this very serious look in his face, was like, "Do you need money? Like, I'm worried about you. Are you shoestringing this?" And I told him, like, "I'm all set. I've got an advance from my publisher," that kind of thing. But he seemed, I don't know, ready to write me a check for the next week of the road trip right then and there. I couldn't believe it.
Well, you mentioned that these conversations about bathroom bills were going on at the time, and obviously you'd need to use bathrooms during a 6-week road trip. But did you have any run-ins that concerned you?
You know, not really. I mean, I think it's ironic that, Texas legislators have tried so hard to keep transgender people from using the right restrooms. But in the process, they've probably caused a lot of transgender people to use the restrooms in the Texas state capitol because they keep coming back to protest the bill over and over again. And you have to go to the bathroom during the protest. So These Texas state legislatures, these legislators are actually kind of inadvertently bringing all the transgender people in the state into their front yard.
The unintended consequences, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, you went, Samantha, deliberately to places that are often dismissed as the flyover states, right? You know, LGBTQ folks are everywhere, not just on the coast. So what did you find are some of the perceptions in red states and in the South that maybe you were even trying to change or challenge with this book?
You know, I think kind of the dominant narrative I wanted to shift was, I think in the 20th century, when we thought of LGBT people, we thought, oh, they get on a bus in Kansas and they show up at the Big Apple, you know, with a suitcase in their hand, and they build a life in New York, or maybe they build a life in San Francisco. And when you look at what's happening demographically in the country with millennials who are more likely to identify as LGBT moving south and west, and with more people in the South and West coming out as LGBT, the kind of queer center of gravity in the country is really shifting, I think, in ways that have largely gone unnoticed by kind of coastal LGBT communities or mainstream media. And that's kind of a sentiment I encountered over and over again, was not really feeling seen. You know, being in places like Atlanta that have a thriving LGBT community, but that still kind of flies under the radar of national consciousness, I think.
Well, of course, yeah. The urban environments, people who are different from one another, kind of squished together in apartment complexes or buildings. But we do see plenty of studies that show that interactions with people of different races, religions, sexual orientations, and so forth help erode the discrimination and prejudice. So when you were in rural areas of red states, did you see maybe, you know, good open people who just maybe hadn't had the chance to know or interact with people like you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most rural places I went to was called New Hope, Texas. It's outside of Dallas. You know, just kind of lots of like 50-acre plots, very rural, tiny little town hall. And my friend Jess Herbst is the mayor, or was the mayor of that town at the time, and she was the first openly transgender mayor in Texas history. And I had the privilege of going to this kind of city hall town council meeting with her. And, you know, it was clear that the residents of this town hadn't really met a transgender person before Jess came out. They were still kind of figuring out, how to address her. I saw, you know, folks at the meeting kind of slip up on her pronouns, calling her she and her a time or two. But they were kind-hearted. They were trying to do better. And the fact that they had known Jess for years before she came out kind of really, I think, changed some hearts and minds. And I think that's what we're seeing, even in more rural parts of the country, is LGBT people coming out and interacting with their family and friends and just kind of slowly washing away some of those past prejudices.
We're talking with Samantha Allen, a reporter who set out to tell stories of LGBTQ people, primarily in red states. Finding people who have worked to turn their communities around and maybe help create more tolerance. Samantha, I think that is something that a lot of people are afraid of or of tripping up on, you know, using the right pronoun. How do you kind of help somebody that you're just meeting through that kind of conversation? Do you just sort of lay it all out at the beginning?
It's kind of, I think it's important to just kind of take people where they are. I can draw from my own personal experience, and I wrote about this a bit in the book with my own parents, you know. When I came out to them, it took them by surprise. And, of course, kind of in the, early days of my transition, I was really insistent that they get on board quickly. I felt like I was making up for lost time. I was 24 years old. I had wanted to transition probably, you know, since I was a teenager, right? But kind of looking back now, I wish I had been a little more patient with them, took them by the hand and walked them through it a little more slowly and carefully than I did.
How would you recommend somebody lead parents by the hand differently?
I would recommend getting them online. You know, there's a lot of vocabulary that people have to learn. Transgender, cisgender, which means not transgender. What are pronouns? What different pronouns do people use? And I just think, it's important that to kind of exercise compassion on both sides.
Well, in addition to towns like New Hope, were there any other little communities that you found in smaller towns, Texas, Tennessee, Georgia, Utah, where you saw burgeoning movements or people, were they generally connected in the LGBT communities or living, as you said, you know, these little satellites that spread out in other places?
I think one of the most surprising things to me is just how ubiquitous these little satellite towns are. There's one everywhere. And, you know, and I had plotted out a lot of the trip in advance. I wasn't really expecting to go anywhere kind of that wasn't already on my itinerary. You know, I had a limited budget. But when I was going through Arkansas, people started telling me about this town in northwest Arkansas called Eureka Springs that I had never heard about before. And they're just like, you have to go, you have to go. So we drove about kind of an hour and a half north of Fayetteville through these kind of beautiful forests. It's in the middle of the Ozark Mountains. And then suddenly you're in this charming little town full of bed and breakfasts and underground springs. And, you know, you walk in any gift shop and it's owned by some gay male couple that also runs a bed and breakfast in town. And it's just this magical little place in the middle of Arkansas that, you know, I think most people probably don't even know exists. And there's probably places like that in every state that I've never heard of before, but would love to visit.
Were any of the people who you spoke to in these towns facing any, outright intolerance or even hostility? Or did they talk to you about inroads that they had made? And how was that done?
The most impressive thing to me as an LGBT journalist is getting the opportunity to kind of go on the ground and talk with folks about how change is kind of actually happening. Because from a national media perspective, often the stories we hear are just, oh, this anti-LGBT law got passed or this anti-LGBT law got stopped. And we're not really seeing what's happening on the ground. And what's happening kind of in these red states is really just kind of the simple power of conversation, friends and family members talking to each other. I mean, one of the most moving moments of the trip for me was being with a Mormon mom in Utah whose son had just come out as transgender, I think like 2 weeks before we interviewed them. And it was just incredible to see them talking through this. And, here was someone who 10 years ago might not have understood LGBT issues or been as sympathetic to them as she was today. And it had just happened from talking to her son, asking questions, trying to figure out how he could be happy. When we see something like an anti-LGBT law getting defeated, you know, we can chalk it up to the work that political advocacy groups do or to fundraising or that kind of thing. But in reality, I think the kind of engine that's driving it is just people talking to each other and so treating each other like humans.
Human interaction instead of all of the lines drawn in the sand between us and them.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know, when we hear like anti-LGBT pundits or that kind of thing, a lot of it is just noise. And I think when you look at public opinion polling in the country and how kind of views on same-sex marriage and transgender rights have really kind of been headed in the right direction for the last 5 years, 10 years, you know, there's a movement happening in this country, all over this country, and it can't be stopped. It's just going to keep going.
We're getting the view from the ground and from the road with Samantha Allen. She's a GLAAD award-winning reporter and author of the book Real Queer America that crossed red states to find stories about LGBT people. And we'll be back with more after a quick break. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and my guest is Samantha Allen, who had a transformation in her own life and set out to tell stories of LGBT people in red states across the Southwest and the South. And her book chronicling that is called Real Queer America. Samantha, your first chapter deals with being LGBT in the current political climate. When did you start writing it?
Shortly after the election.
Okay, so the election of 2016 then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So did your focus change over the course of the Trump presidency?
I think the Trump presidency was a real wake-up call for folks. I think it was more of a wake-up call for folks living in blue states, coastal states, than it was for some of the people that I interviewed and profiled in the book. You know, a lot of people that I met in red states, LGBT activists, organizers, and just everyday LGBT folks, they weren't necessarily surprised that Trump won. I feel like they had more of a read on where his support came from and what we're up against, progressive-minded folks in the country are up against. And so it was kind of interesting to go kind of from, you know, my day job as a national reporter back into these communities that had sort of seen the outcome of the election coming, I feel like, more than the establishment press did.
That's interesting. Obviously, that is something. There was much hand-wringing after the election from the media, the national media, saying, like, how did we miss this? But you were getting a very close-up view. No surprise to you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the things that I think has really been interesting is the how did we miss this question is often phrased as, I don't know, how did we miss the story of the Trump supporter in the red state? But part of what I wanted to write about and address in the book is I think we're also missing the LGBT, women's rights supporters in red states. I feel like we're not hearing enough stories about progressive people in red states. I feel like we're just missing a lot. And I wanted to contribute to the conversation. You shouldn't just be asking yourself, how did Trump happen and how did we miss it? You should be asking yourself, who are the people living in these places that helped elect Trump, who didn't want it to happen, who fought against it, and who under his presidency are fighting to make their states more welcoming to LGBT people, people of color, immigrants, that kind of thing.
Well, and you write in the book about places that have been accepting for a long time, those meccas, in addition to the small communities like Atlanta, still the best place to be queer or bi or trans in the country, you write. Why is that?
the queer community in Atlanta is just, it's so vibrant. It's so warm. I love Atlanta Pride. When I lived there, I marched in Atlanta Pride. I walked around and, I don't know, filled canvas bags full of swag from all the booths and that kind of thing. Atlanta's just an amazing, beautiful, diverse city. It was a privilege to live there for as long as I did. And part of what I feel like gives the community that sense of cohesiveness. You know, it's not absolutely perfect. No community ever is. But what a lot of folks say to me is, in Atlanta, everybody in the LGBT community kind of had to come up together. You know, the gay folks, the bi folks, the trans folks, everybody had to kind of fight at the same time. You compare that with a state like, say, Massachusetts, where you have kind of same-sex marriage rights get way out in front of trans issues. And it leads, I think, to a little more disconnectedness in the community. Mm. In Atlanta, I just kind of feel, I don't know, you hang out with everyone. Everyone hangs out together.
Atlanta, as you mentioned, was a place where you had your first conversations about being trans and transitioned. What were those conversations like back in 2012, and what was the context?
Oh, my gosh. So I was in graduate school at Emory University, and, you know, in the humanities, like, theoretically, I shouldn't have been all that afraid, but even in 2012, even after a few years of living in Atlanta, I still had a lot of preconceptions about Georgia, about the South. I just assumed that it wouldn't be a very welcoming place to come out. And I was worried, frankly, about living in the South and coming out and being trans. And a lot of those fears just kind of evaporated. I came out to my mentor at Emory University, Michael Schutt, who does a lot of work with Georgia Equality. He was the head of the Office of LGBT Life at Emory University at the time. And he was just like, oh, great. We have, you know, a world-renowned hormone expert, an endocrinologist in the health center. We've got a, you know, a counselor at the Emory Counseling Center who specializes in these issues. And also our health insurance covers all of it and most of the cost of surgery. So you're all set. And I don't know. I couldn't believe it. In transitioning at Emory in Atlanta in Georgia, it couldn't have been a smoother experience. And I don't know. I had a lot of kind of preconceived notions that were just kind of burst overnight.
You mean about the South?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my counselor at the Emory Student Health Center is this lovely queer woman who kind of motorcycle rides with a lot of queer women through the South. You know, she kind of helped me calm down about coming out in Georgia. And I just realized how many people there were in Georgia who cared about these issues and in a really earnest way, because they could see the stakes of it on the ground. You can see why it matters so much.
Are there people that you encountered and they were not in as tolerant communities as those that you're describing, and ask and wonder why they might be staying in a place that was harmful for them or felt dangerous or perilous?
Yeah, you know, I think the place where I encountered that the most was the Rio Grande Valley in places like McAllen, Texas, recently popularized because Trump went down there to talk about the border wall and his national emergency and that kind of thing. But that's a sidebar. When I went to the Rio Grande Valley, I met a lot of LGBT people there who said that they were there because they couldn't leave. It's one of the most impoverished areas of the country. Something like 1 in 3 people there live in poverty. And for undocumented folks in that part of the country, you know, you have this kind of almost militarized border to the south, and then you have interior border checkpoints 100 miles north, which make it, you know, hard to get up to Austin or up Dallas or that kind of thing. And so, you know, a lot of places that I went to that were more tolerant, people were like, I like it here. I want to stay here. I want to help change things here. I met people in the Rio Grande Valley who said, I'm here because I can't go anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But even then, they were starting to say, well, I'm stuck here. I might as well make it more inclusive and welcoming. I might as well make this a place that LGBT people can call home. And I met some of the most amazing young Mexican American folks there who were just like doing incredible work to reshape the Rio Grande.
So they felt like they had to be responsible in some way for opening up minds or showing that, you know, we're here, to use the old statement?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of felt like their backs were against the wall. I met one non-binary person there who uses they and them as a pronoun. And they told me, we're like cactuses down here. We have to grow in the hard places. And, you know, this was a person who's gets shouted at on the street when they're out in public or, experiences some of the kind of anti-LGBT sentiment that can crop up down there, despite it, you know, being an area that votes blue on kind of other social issues. And they just felt, I don't know, this remarkable resilience in the face of that sentiment.
We're getting a view of LGBT communities in red states from Samantha Allen, who went on a long road trip and covered a lot of ground and wrote about it in her book, Real Queer America. It strikes me that that is kind of the trajectory of activism in some way, right? You know, when you are the first in a place, you either choose to be, you know, kind of disappear and assimilate as best one can if you are an other, so to speak, or become an activist. And it is a kind of hallmark of the first wave of activism. And then the second wave is a little less active. And then the third or fourth, you know, might be a little more comfortable in their spot, not wanting to necessarily make waves. Do you see that as a sign on some level of success?
I kind of worry about complacency, personally. I think one of the reasons why I found writing this book so energizing is because I was largely visiting places that were in that kind of like first or second wave of LGBT activism, and being someone who also spends a fair amount of time in kind of more liberal coastal states, I worry a bit about people, I don't know, letting their guard down because, even in places like New York didn't get transgender non-discrimination protections into its state law until this year, 2019. A lot of people probably assumed it had happened already. So when people let their guards down, we don't see progress as quickly as it should happen. And then we can also see kind of surprising rollbacks, like this happened over a decade ago, but it's one of the most kind of visceral ones. Proposition 8 in California, when same-sex marriage was suddenly made illegal, it took a lot of folks by surprise. They thought, how could this happen? It's California. But if you get too complacent, if you don't show up to the polls, if you don't kind of mobilize or organize, things can take you by surprise.
Mm. Well, after all of your motion around the country, East Tennessee eventually felt like home to you. Why was that a place that felt right?
I first went to East Tennessee for a fan convention, actually, like a comic book convention. It was this little town in East Tennessee, about an hour west of Asheville, called Johnson City. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of it before. I went there, and I just met the most amazing people there. A lot of kind of like bisexual and queer people. And I met my best friends, Jen and Justin, there, kind of instantly fell in love with them and their dogs, Red and Doc, and their tortoise, Zelda. It's just kind of this beautiful tucked away little town with a kind of Al Capone-esque downtown area, very like 1920s feeling, railroad running through the town. it's just a gem. And I think for me, it was sort of, I don't know, emblematic of what a lot of small town America can be like. It's out there waiting for you. And there are so many places that you've never heard of, but you could, I don't know, pull out any state map and find a little place and look it up online and be surprised by what you find there.
Well, you, like many people who you met, did maybe not necessarily got on the bus in Kansas City and lit out for the big city, but did leave things behind and maybe had to break ties in order to find their communities of choice and their new places to live. What does that do to the whole notion of home and place? You know, that one's identity is often associated with a home. So what does it offer to make a new identity in a new place?
I think one of the biggest ideas I explored in the book, and part of what you're getting at, is like home is something you carry with us, and people have really complex relationships to their own personal notions of home. It's always been a challenging question for me. I've lived in California, New Jersey, Utah, Montana, Indiana for a summer, Atlanta, South Florida, Washington State. I've lived all over. Never really stayed anywhere super long since turning 18. And so for me, it's hard for me to even answer the question of where is home. I've always kind of coveted a more kind of permanent sense of home. It's one of the joys of writing the book was I got to meet people who had a real sense of attachment to one place. But you're right, I did meet people who had to kind of leave those attachments behind. I think one of the most heartbreaking examples of that is Jackson, Mississippi. It's a city that a lot of young folks leave. And that, you know, hurts the economy of Jackson, Mississippi. It hurts the state politics of Mississippi if you care about LGBT rights. And I have friends. I have a good friend in Atlanta, Kaylee, mentioned in the book, who grew up in Mississippi, but had to leave it behind for work opportunity. But she feels just so shaped by this place. I met her in Atlanta and she wouldn't shut up about Jackson, Mississippi, frankly. She just talked about it all the time to the point where I was like, I have to go to this place now. You talk about it every time we hang out. And I went there and I just saw what she loved about her home, and I saw how it had shaped her. Kaylee is a very outspoken ally to the transgender community, and I saw how being in a place like Mississippi, where you have to be outspoken and brave in order to kind of get by, I saw how it her home had made her who she was. And I think no matter where your home is or if you have a fractured sense of home, you're always shaped by the places you've been.
Mm. Samantha, I was joking a little bit about the idea of using this as a green book for LGBT people, but do you think that people will use it as a guide?
Gosh, I hope that everyone who reads it goes to Johnson City.
You're going to welcome them all?
Yeah. I'm not a Mormon missionary anymore. I will be an evangelist for Johnson City, Tennessee. It's amazing.
Samantha Allen, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Samantha Allen's new book, Real Queer America, LGBT Stories from Red States, is out today. And that is a wrap for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alex Word is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. If you missed any of today's show or would like to listen on your own time or share it with somebody else, you can hit the programs tab for On Second Thought at gpbnews.org. You'll find individual segments to share, or you can subscribe to the OST podcast so you will never miss a conversation. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for joining us on Second Thought.